Okay, we're looking at Ezekiel chapters 8 and 9 tonight. In the very first verse of chapter 8, it says, "It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month." If you'll go back to chapter 1, and verse 1 says, "On the fifth day of the fourth month, in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's exile," verse 2. So we're now in the sixth year of the sixth month. So we're about 14 months after that chapter and verse when he began his prophetic work. And thus far, all his prophecy has been, as Matt stated in his prayer, prophecies of warning about judgment coming upon Jerusalem. He's not in Jerusalem. He's where? Where is Ezekiel? In Babylon, prophesying to the exiles there. But in chapter 8, he's going to be carried in a vision to Jerusalem. He's not actually going to travel there. It's going to be a vision that God's going to show him some things that's going on in Jerusalem. So that's what our chapter 8. So the first four verses of chapter 8, the occasion and nature of this vision. Just remember, it's a vision. And then verse 5 through 18, the contents of the vision. We'll have some subdivisions as we get through that section. So as you look in chapter 8, verse 1, this is where this starts. "It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord God fell on me there." We talked about this phrase in an earlier chapter. "Hand of the Lord fell upon him" is simply talking about a divine influence or power exerted upon him. Now look at the 11th chapter. And the last verse, so we have on your outline chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. And if time allows, we're going to study those four chapters in two classes, 8, 9, 10, and 11. But 8, 9, 10, and 11 form a unit. And you'll see 11:25, "Then I told the exiles all the things the Lord had shown me." So he's going to be shown some things. Chapter 8, some things in Jerusalem, and 9, 10, and then he's going to go back and tell the exiles about that. They did not want to hear the kind of things he would tell them, but they needed to hear them. They were warnings, and there were other prophets who were saying it would not happen, but Ezekiel was a true prophet, and the truth of his prophecy would be vindicated within about how many years? 15, 20?
About 6 years.
So we started out around 592, 93. We're using the 592 date. Some make it 593, but somewhere in that area. And now we've moved a year on down, and the fall of Jerusalem was 587 or 6. So it's a short time before his prophecies will be vindicated about what's going to happen to Jerusalem. Back in chapter 5 and in verse 5, note what Jerusalem is called: the center of the nations. God put his name there. That's a phrase used to indicate that there was a building there that was to represent his dwelling place among the people. It was a very critical, very important city in God's dealing with the nations, the center of the nations. It may be, but they still have to do the will of God, and if not, judgment falls. So don't ever think that we're so important that judgment won't fall. That's what we're going to read about in these chapters. So it says he's sitting with the elders of Judah. We talked about his age. Chapter 1 tells us his age when we began the book. About how old would he be 14 months later? About how old is Ezekiel now? about 31, 32 years old, somewhere in that area, because in the first chapter is in his 30th year. So here's a young man, early 30s, and here come the elders, the ones who are supposed to be the leaders, the knowledgeable men, coming to this young man. Why did they come to him? We do not know. Did they come seeking word of comfort in view of all of the prophecies that of judgment? Did they come to ask questions? What was their purpose in coming? Did they come to appeal to him not to prophesy so negatively? We don't know. The text doesn't say. And so here's this young man sitting before these elders, and then this vision, he tells about this vision that he tells to the exiles. Now, if you go over to chapter 24, chapter 20, verse 4. 20 and verse 1, you see the elders came to him again in chapter 20 and verse 1. Now, back up to chapter 14. So it's not the only time the elders came to him. Now back up to 14. You have them coming to him here. Elders of Israel came to me. But here's what's interesting is in verse 4. Speak to them and tell them, thus says the Lord God, any man of the house of Israel who sets up his idols in his heart, puts right before his face the stumbling block of his iniquity, and then comes to the prophet. So you saw in chapter 8, they're coming to the prophet. You saw in chapter 20, they're coming to the prophet. Chapter 14, they're coming to the prophet. They may be coming to the prophet and say, we're not practicing idolatry. We're not bowing down to idols. But chapter 14, verse 4, if these are the same elders, then here what we have is they're worshiping idols in their heart. Are they trusting in the idols to deliver them? Are they showing some secret adoration for these idols as if they'll give them guidance? Don't know what all the extent of it was with these men. We're going to see how involved the nation was as we get through chapter 8. Now, it may have been that Ezekiel was a bit hesitant to preach this kind of a message. You know, you don't always, if you're a preacher to people that are your people, always be preaching negative things. But God's going to open his eyes to see why he's got this dire message of judgment by this vision that he's going to allow Ezekiel to participate in. Yes?
You were asking in chapter 8, you don't know why the elders came. I'm wondering in 6:3 on that oracle, it says, and say mountain to the living of the word of the Lord, and you speak to them. I wonder if they heard that oracle in chapter 6. That's why they're coming in chapter 8.
6:3?
Yeah, 6:3.
To the mountains of Israel?
Yeah.
Could be. But if they're coming, what are they asking for? Are they asking for that Ezekiel do something about it, or... I don't know what they're seeking. I don't know what other inquiry. He's been preaching now over a year, hasn't he? And so I don't know. But anyway, so it'd be easy for a young man, 30, 31, to be intimidated by these fellows. God will not allow it. He said, I've got this job for you to do. I'm sending you to some stubborn people, and you're going to do your job, or you'll be rebellious. And so God said, now let me show you some things, Ezekiel. This may help you understand why these things are being pronounced against the nation of Israel. So look in verse 2. I looked and behold a likeness as of the appearance of a man. It doesn't say he's a man. As of the appearance of a man. This may very well have been an angel. And it says from his loins and downward there was an appearance of fire. Fire is often associated with judgment. And from his loins and upward, the appearance of brightness like the appearance of glowing metal. Again, we can't take every detail and give it a meaning. It's just the appearance that he sees. It's a stunning appearance of this personage, whoever he was. He stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by the lock of my head. and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God. Back in chapter 1, when we saw about that vision, we see about the Spirit of the living being. And then chapter 3 and verse 12, the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard a great rumbling sound behind me. Blessed be the glory of the Lord in His place. So we talk about God the Father, and we talk about God the Son, but the Holy Spirit's involved in these things, has always been involved in man's welfare from the beginning. And we see here the Spirit lifted him up between earth and heaven, brought him in the visions of God. Remember, we have this phrase occurring three times in the book. And it's not a vision of God in the sense that God is what he sees. Remember, we talked about visions of God. They use that phrase to do what? When they put of God on it. What? Mountains of God. What kind of mountains are that? Big, great mountains. That's the idea. Visions of God. This is an astounding vision. This is a great vision. Visions of God. And we find it three times in the book. And so, but he brings him to Jerusalem. So, okay, here Ezekiel's over in Babylon, but in this vision he's brought to the temple area. You see, and one of the things we had suggested that you do in your markings is mark the geographical markings. And if you did that throughout here, it's kind of interesting, the various places that he's brought. I've got those marked in my text. And so as I look at it, I can immediately see these various places, beginning with just the statement about the city. But now he's brought to the north gate, as you see here in verse 3. And it's the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy. We've talked about in sermons and in classes about this little word of, and that it often has different meanings. In fact, you'll see down here in verse 4, the glory of the God of Israel is the glory God possesses, called genitive of possession, glory that God possesses. But that's not the meaning here. The idol of jealousy is explained in the next phrase. This is a good passage to remember, marked somewhere, to show the difference in the little word of and how it's used. What does he mean by the idol of jealousy? Here the word of is pointing to some relation between the word before and the word after the word of. He says, it's the idol of jealousy which provokes to jealousy. God's a jealous God, and here's why God is bringing judgment. He did not permit them to worship other gods. And so idol of jealousy has to do with the stirring of God's anger against the people for practicing this idolatry. And so what was the idol? It's not identified. Just some idol. Imagine as you enter the church building, there's the doors. First thing you see is an idol. You enter the north gate. Here's an idol. And so Ezekiel might have known the people were bad. He might not have known they were this bad, that right in their area of worship, they've got an idol. We talked about this in the time of Josiah, that in the time of Josiah, the kings before him had not only practiced idolatry, but brought immoral idolatry right into the temple area. But here you'd think they've learned their lesson, haven't they? No. Here it is now. Even after Nebuchadnezzar came in 605, and even after he came in 597, and they still not learned their lesson. And so here's this idol as you go into the north gate. And he said, behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw in the plain. That's where we started in chapter 1, with this vision, impressing him with the glory of God, thus emphasizing upon him the solemnity of his mission to preach this message, that it's God that's commissioning him to preach this message. It also gives credibility to the prophecies that would be made about what would happen and the charges that would be brought, the indictments that would be brought against the nation. Then he said to me, son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gate was this idol of jealousy at the entrance. So question on your lesson, in the following verses, we ask two things. One, what is being worshipped? And two, who is worshipping? So the first thing, number one, of course, an unidentified idol, verse 5. Not much more said about it except some kind of an image that was worshipped. But now who is engaged in this? It's the people that are engaged in this. He said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The great abomination which the house of Israel are committing here, so that I would be far from my sanctuary. Now, one reason we know it's the people here is because of the distinction made in the other subdivisions in this chapter. We have just two subdivisions on your outline to the chapter, but actually there are several subdivisions. I have 1 through 4 and 5 through 18, but as we go through, you'll see that there are other subdivisions. So in 5 and 6, you'll see the abominations of the people. And the people are worshiping an unidentified idol, 5 and 6. And when we get to 7 through 18, it'd be another group. When we get to 14 and 15, another group. And then in 16 and 17, another group. So you've got these different groups that are focused on, called out throughout this chapter to emphasize the abominations. One of the questions on the lesson that we have on your outline well, it's on number 9, I guess, on chapter 9. Question 2, why was this destruction decreed? You look on chapter, the lesson on chapter 9, question 2. One of the markings we suggested that you mark, one of the things you look for, are the abomination, iniquity, sin, transgression markings. As you start reading through the chapter, you're going to see this. In chapter 8 and verse 6, you have the word, the great abominations. What great abominations? In this case, worshiping something else besides Jehovah God. To worship is to give adoration, to attribute powers to something that is beyond that which human beings possess, to attribute to these things knowledge and influence that human beings do not possess. That's what you do when you worship a god. And they're somehow trusting in these idols and attributing these man-made things with those kind of powers. It's amazing that people would do that, but they've done it in the past. They're doing it today. All you've got to do is drive through Houston to see the same kind of thing going on. But at the end of verse 6, if that wasn't enough, you see greater abomination. Now, one of the phrases we suggested you look at is the things that talk about what he's going to see. Mark the phrases, do you see what they are doing? And those kind of phrases are all through this chapter. So he's been taken in a vision of Jerusalem. He said, let me show you something, Ezekiel. You see what they're doing at the north gate? But he said, let me tell you, Ezekiel, that's just the beginning. There's greater stuff. There's more coming. Just wait. So then, verse 7, he brought me to the entrance of the court. And when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. Now, if you did the geographical markings, you highlighted that. Not just the court, but there's a wall and there's a hole in the wall. He said to me, Son of man, I dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall. And behold, an entrance. He said to me, go in and see. Now, here's one of our phrases. Here, let me show you. It's that wall. Dig in there. Go through there. Go in there and see what's going on. You know, men think they can hide from God. They do things when they get home, men and women. They shout at one another. They mistreat one another. They misaccuse one another. But that's at home. That's not at the church building where people can see. People go to the movie house and it's dark and watch things. I guess they think God can't see in the dark. I don't know. Young people go on dates and do things. Do they think God don't know if they're away from home or that kind of thing? People go on vacations and go places they normally wouldn't go. This chapter is very practical. There is no place we can hide. There's no place we can shut the doors that God can't see. And he said, Ezekiel, here, go through that little hole right there. There's an entrance. Go in there and see what's going on. And so that's what we have here. And he says, here's again the wicked abominations that they're committing here. And so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on all on the wall all around. Now, we ask you the question on your lesson, what were they worshiping? And so what did you put for that? They were worshiping beasts and reptiles and idols carved on the wall. Beasts and reptiles carved on the wall, and then other idols. We don't know the nature of them. But here's what's really interesting. We ask who's involved in this inner practice in hiding. And so, look at verse 11. Standing in front of them were 70 elders. Elders? Aren't they supposed to be the leaders? Aren't they supposed to guard the people? They're practicing this very thing. 70 of them in hiding. What has happened to these men? Where did they go astray? And then it says, with Jezaniah the son of Shaphan standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand, the fragrance of the cloud of incense arising. This Jezaniah, son of Shaphan, this fellow Shaphan, you can go back and look, he was a scribe for Josiah. Who was Josiah? What kind of king was he?
He was a good king.
The best king the southern kingdom ever had. This fellow was at his right hand, like a secretary of state almost. It's his son. It's his son that's in there with these elders. And then, standing among them. And what's interesting about this, further about this, he's the brother of Ahikam, A-H-I-K-A-M, which was Jeremiah's friend. So here's Jezaniah's father was ascribed to Josiah. Jezaniah's brother, Ahikam, was a friend of Jeremiah. And Ahikam was the father of Gedaliah, which was also Jeremiah's friend. So he had a son, Ahikam did, who was a friend of Jeremiah. I just came back from a family gathering. But not all my family was there. Because I told them they couldn't come. You know, families, you think, well, boy, if it's family, it's going to all be all right. Not necessarily. Here's a good man, Shaphan. Look at his son. But his brother, evidently a good man. And his brother's son, a good man. But corruption in families. Look, division in families, hypocrisy among families, nothing new. And here's what Ezekiel is allowed to see. Verse 12 said to me, son of man, do you see? Do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark? Each man in the room of his carved image. Why did they go in the dark and go in this little room? The answer is at the end of the verse. Where they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. Did they think the Lord had forsaken the land because of the captivity in 605? Because of the captivity in 597? Well, the Lord don't care about us anymore. He don't know what we're doing. Don't care what we're doing. Is that what people think? If something goes wrong in life and people get sick or a loved one dies or some catastrophe happens, if this nation was to fall to another nation, do we think, well, the Lord wasn't watching over, wasn't blessing America? After all, He's gone. We'll do what we want. And so they get over this little hole in the wall, go through there and practice this stuff. If they thought it was right, why did they do it out in the courtyard? We give lie to the things that we do. We acknowledge by sometimes the way we do them that we know they're wrong. But look at verse 13. Yet he said to me, yet you will see still greater abominations. What? The people worshiping at the north gate, this idol. Over in secret are these elders worshiping all this, these reptiles and beasts and idols in this secret room. There's more coming. So now we get to verse 14 and 15. He brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which is toward the north. You know, in a society, if you look at the people who you would think maybe aren't the ones who would lead apostasy, maybe more genteel in nature. You might think of the women. Maybe the women will hold on. But look who's involved now. This answers our question here on your lesson. Who's involved in this? He says, the women. The women. And so this is our next subdivision, 14 and 15. And they're worshiping what's called here in your text, Tammuz. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correct. And there's various conjectures about what this was, whether it was an idol or other things, but it definitely connected with some kind of an idolatrous practice. And here we see the women involved in it. They're weeping for the idol. Can you imagine that? Not weeping for Jehovah. He said to me, "Do you see this, son of man?" Do you remember earlier in the book of Ezekiel we talked about how this hurt God? Imagine how God must have felt. They're weeping not for me, but for this T-A-M-M-U-Z, whatever that was. He said, "Yet you will see still greater abominations than these." Well, how can it be greater? The people, the elders, the women? Is there no group in their society that knew the law, knew the warnings that they could go to? So we get to our next subdivision, verse 16, 17. He brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. Go in the temple and you face west. They're facing the east. That in and of itself may indicate their idolatrous views. They were prostrating themselves toward the sun. Who's doing it now? It's priest. Priest. You know, it'd be bad enough if you came to the building and you saw an idol. That's one thing. And then if you walked in and you saw older people maybe involved in maybe they open their Bibles and they've got little idols in their Bibles. And then you see the women crying over their idol. But what if the elders, I'm talking about the men who ought to know, and the preacher themselves are involved in it? They say, "I'm telling you, the priest, they're the teachers. They're the ones who are supposed to teach the people the law." 25 men. He said, "Do you see this, son of man?" Say over and over, "Do you see this? Do you see this?" You just remember that. There's things God sees that we don't. When God brings judgment on nations, we may wonder, why did he do that? God sees things we don't see. When things happen in life that we can't explain, remember this. God sees things that we don't see. And there's a reason he does what he does. How foolish it would have been for Ezekiel to rebel, or for the whatever good people were that he was preaching to rebel, because God's bringing judgment on Jerusalem, because they didn't understand. They didn't think it was fair. They didn't see what God sees. And so verse 17, he said to me, "Do you see this, son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abomination which they've committed here, that they've filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly?" People get to thinking sin is a light thing. They don't take it seriously. And so there's some kind of a practice in their day, putting the twig to the nose in association with that. But they didn't have the fear of God they should have had for the deeds that they were doing. And we can get to where we practice something long enough, I guess it just doesn't bother us. I know there's been elders involved in immorality while they're still serving as elders, and preachers that are involved with immorality with members of the congregation while they're still standing up at the pulpit preaching on Sunday. And it can happen to you and it can happen to me. And the moment we think it can't happen to us, that's dangerous. It can happen to us. Now note the first word of verse 18, "Therefore." Let me tell you why all this is happening, Ezekiel. Here's the therefore. Therefore, I will deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, yet I will not listen to them. Wow. Is this the God of love that sent Jesus on Christmas to die for man? He did, didn't he? So everybody get along? Of course, that's not true. Doesn't he just love everybody? Yes. Does that mean he's going to look the other way about people's sin? No. Does he get mad? Yes. Does he get angry? Yes. He said, they can cry all they want. I'm not listening. Good grief. Think about that. When we pursue a life, people pursue a life of ignoring God, then they get in trouble. Oh, Lord God, help me. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. He said, I'm not listening.
A lot of people take the whole thing with love, that you love somebody, you will accept what they do, and they think if you go against them, it's not love. But if they sin and try to rebuke them and tell them it's wrong, a lot of people think that you don't love.
Okay, that's true. Sometimes the love does hard things. That's right, Brad. And, of course, God is sending Ezekiel to these people. Why?
Get them to repent.
Get them to repent because he loves them. And sometimes if you love people, you tell them things they need to hear they don't want to hear. So I just love them too much to say, no, you may love yourself because you don't get yourself in hot water. But if you love them, you may say some things they really don't like to hear. Yes, sir?
What about the last phrase in verse 17? Is that some form of idol worship?
We're not sure. It could be a pagan practice. There's various conjectures on what it means. Like in Job 21, 26 through 28, they talk about kissing their hand toward the sun. So it may be an idolatrous type practice. But we don't know for sure. Hosea 4:12 talks about divining by rods, so it may have been they're using this for the purpose of divining. But as we know, I didn't spend much time on it because it's a conjecture. But it has something to do with their idolatry. I'm not sure what. Okay, so verse 18 is a concluding statement to that chapter. Let's go to chapter 9. Now on your outline, on your lesson, we have four divisions in chapter 9. First two verses where God summons the executioners. They're called executioners in verse 1. In the New American, your version may call it something else there in verse 1. But that's the idea. They're going to be destroying. You see in verse 1, they're going to have a destroying weapon. The destroying weapon in this chapter is not called a sword. It's a word that may indicate something like a hammer or something to batter and crush. But the idea is there's going to be destruction in the city. And so that's verse 1 and 2. He's commissioning these executioners. He cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. So try to envision this. Remember, he's seeing a vision. This is not happening. This is a vision about what's going to happen in a short time. And I don't know if we'll have time. I know we won't this class. But David, you see a similar type thing with David when he had sinned and he put himself in God's hand and the angel was ready to strike the city of Jerusalem and God withheld his hand. So these aren't called angels, that word, but that's very possibly what they were, angels that God employed to do his work. The study of angels is a very interesting topic. If you ever had time, study Daniel 10 through 12. A lot there I don't know, but it's a real interesting insight into the role of angels and their involvement in the destiny of nations. But nevertheless, here are these executioners. Behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon. What was that? What did it look like? I don't know. Something that shattered, a crush. Here are these very powerful beings coming upon the city. With them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case in his loins. And we'll read about him at the end of the chapter as well. He's writing a record. What's he writing? We'll see in just a moment. And so that's what we have. So that's verse 3 through 7. And you'll see we have that. We ask you the question, in fact. Question number one, what lesson is learned from the mark of the forehead? Who is putting the mark on the forehead? Okay, get down to verse 3. Let's go to 3. The glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been. Remember the cherub, the idea of God riding on a chariot? That idea of the four living beings? He gets up out of the cherub. Goes to the threshold of the temple. He called to the man clothed in linen, whose loins was the writing case. The Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even to the midst of the Jerusalem, and put a mark. So this guy with this writing tablet going to go through the city, going to mark this one. Go there and mark that one. Mark that one. And we ask you the question, what's the marking about? Who are the people that are marked, verse 4? Try. They're not happy about the state of things. They're not comfortable with it at all. They're weeping, but not weeping because of Tammuz, whoever that was. They're sighing and groaning. Our nation's a mess. Sin is rampant. You ever weep figuratively over the apostasy in our country and sometimes even among God's people? Does God know that? Yeah. He knows that. He knows what you pray. He knows what's in your heart. And so this person goes through and marks those who do not share the laxity or in the practices of the people around them. Someday you might find yourself in a church full of corruption. You read anybody in any churches full of corruption in the New Testament? Tell me one. Corinth. Imagine you're sitting on the pew. There's a guy, he's there with his father's wife living in open sin. Nobody did anything about it. You may go home and cry and weep and pray. Does God know? Yeah, he knows. In Sardis, he said the church was dead, but what else did he say? Some of you walk with me in white, didn't he? And so God knows. And this idea that God knows His own is something you find throughout the Bible. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul told Timothy that right there in Ephesus, he was going to deal with some very difficult times in chapter 3. There were already false teachers present. But he's going to deal with difficult times in chapter 3 where men were going to have a form of godliness but not the power of it. But in chapter 2, and in verse 19, there's this little statement. The firm foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows those who are His. He knows. Look back in the book of Nahum in the Old Testament. Nahum chapter 1, verse 7. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and He knows those who take refuge in Him. He knows. Look at John chapter 10 and verse 14. Jesus is the good shepherd. Look what He said. I'm the good shepherd. I know my own. The Pharisees pretended to be the spiritual leaders. He said, I know my own. I know them. In Revelation chapter 7, look at Revelation chapter 7. Again, a book about judgment because of ungodliness. In chapter 7, verse 3, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. You read later in the book as if God's name was written on their foreheads. These belong to God. Yeah, things are bad. There's judgment coming. We hear in Ezekiel, very comforting thing. In the midst of destruction and judgment, this guy goes with his writing pen. You put a mark. You put a mark on those who have godliness, fear of God, reverence for God. What did Jesus say? Blessed are those who, for they'll be comforted. Mourn. Those who mourn. Mourn over sin. They'll be comforted. That attitude is one God commends. So, you have this over and over again, what we read in verse 5. Do not let your eye have pity, and do not spare. That's what he's telling the destroying angels. No mercy. Can you imagine? No mercy. Utterly slay. Old men, young men, maidens, little children and women. But do not touch any man on whom is the mark. And you shall start from my sanctuary. So now, don't take this to mean that the people with the mark live physically. Because when you get later in the book, you'll see that the righteous and wicked suffered death. But even in the face of death, God knows who are His. Real interesting statement in the end of verse 6. Who do they start with?
Elders.
The elders. Start with the elders. He said, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Dead body with unclean. Fill it up. Bunch of dead bodies. Go out. Thus they went out and struck down the people in the city. Not just in the court, but in the city. As they were striking the people. I'm out of time. I'm sorry. I'm over. I got to quit. We'll pick up verse 8.